Wrangle angles for a 23rd term, McCarthyism is on the rise in the House, and seriously, who lost Iraq? I can't find it anywhere. Oh well. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 32 of The Political Junkie. Remember Iraq, the country we thought we put behind us in 2011? Well, the sectarian bloodshed is back. Now President Obama's got another foreign policy headache, and it has unsurprisingly given critics another talking point about his leadership, or lack of it. And wasn't the Tea Party supposed to jump into the vacuum left by the primary defeat of Eric Cantor? Well, right now, it looks like California's Kevin McCarthy is the clear favorite for the job of majority leader. What is he, a nice guy or something? We'll find out. And we look ahead to next week's primaries. In Oklahoma, where the Republican establishment and the Tea Party are having another Senate showdown. And in Manhattan, where Charlie Rangel wants to keep the House seat he's had since 1971. But first, the trivia question. Two African-American senators, Democrat Cory Booker of New Jersey and Republican Tim Scott of South Carolina, are hoping and expected to hold on to their seats in this year's midterm elections. What is the first state to have a black senator and a black governor at the same time? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch, and the winner gets a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And don't forget, you don't have to wait until Thursday to hear the trivia question. Head over to our Political Junkie Facebook page for a sneak peek every Wednesday afternoon. We'll give you the answer to last week's question later in the show. The headlines, once again, are about Iraq. Sick of the war and elected in 2008 on a promise to get the U.S. out, President Obama decided the situation was right in 2011 to withdraw all American troops. Now, members of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, along with Iraqi Sunnis, are in open revolt against the Shiite government, capturing cities, reportedly massacring government soldiers, threatening religious shrines, and ready to turn Iraq and the entire region into a Sunni-Shia conflict that could spread like wildfire. So if Iraq falls to these al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, who's to blame? Is it Obama for relying on a Shia prime minister who had no intention of uniting the country in the first place? Is it George W. Bush, whose overthrow of Saddam Hussein ended a dictatorship, but helped bring the religious hatreds out in the open? I mean, we have to blame someone. That's the nature of politics. Ken Walsh is the longtime chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He writes Ken Walsh's Washington, a blog for U.S. News, and he joins us now. Ken, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Great. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You had a post the other day entitled, Who Lost Iraq? I have to say, it reminded me a little bit of the cry of the early 1950s, Who Lost China?
That's exactly how it came up in my own mind. That was before my time in journalism, but it looked like the world was sort of turning against democracy and capitalism, and that triggered this whole angst in the United States about whether we were really facing up to the challenges from the communists. And we fought that battle for many years after that.
Well, talk about the battle in Washington. I mean, one of the leaders of that battle was Senator Joe McCarthy, the Republican senator from Wisconsin, who used to talk about communist infiltration to the high rankings of the U.S. government. But he also talked that he was one of the proponents of the question, who lost China argument. Here he is in an interview talking about his plans for the 1952 elections.
I intend to go into those states and give the American people the cold documented picture of the sellout in Korea, the extent to which communism has been directing our foreign policy, our suicidal foreign policy, if you please. And if the American people want more of that, then they can vote for the present administration.
That's pretty heavy stuff.
Right, boy, that brings up memories. That dark and brooding voice of Joe McCarthy. Boy, does that bring back memories?
Well, but it's not China anymore, and it's not Korea. It's Iraq, and if Iraq falls, somebody's going to be blamed. Ken Walsh, who gets the blame, and who should get the blame?
Well, you know, I think there's, of course, a lot of blame to go around. I think the first people who should be blamed, frankly, is the government of Maliki, who we have been counting on and urging to broaden his coalition, to not persecute sectarian minorities, try to make peace with the Sunni, and he has not done that. And so now you're seeing, as you said at the top, this tremendous sectarian enmities bubbling to the surface. These have been going on there. The fight between the Shia and the Sunnis for centuries, but you have this civil war that appears to be erupting over there, and the Maliki government does not appear willing or able to heal the country. So it's a very, very dire situation for the Iraqis. Three of our last four presidents have been pulled into this whole Iraqi world. George Herbert Walker Bush, of course, drove the Saddam Hussein-led Iraqis out of Kuwait. George W. Bush invaded Iraq to try to find weapons of mass destruction that they never could find, or that didn't exist. And now President Obama, after pulling our troops out in 2011, is now having to decide how much to re-engage with Iraq. So it's sort of something that keeps coming back and sort of haunts our presidents again and again.
Well, when I asked you the question about who gets to blame, immediately you said it was the Maliki government. And there's truth to that, of course, but what about making the case that when President Obama withdrew the troops in 2011, it was after he felt that he could trust Maliki to unite the country, and Maliki didn't do that. So do the Republicans have a case by saying, well, it was naivety or just bad foreign policy decisions on President Obama's part that led to this crisis?
Yeah, I think there is a case to be made on that score. I mean, you can't ignore the invasion that toppled the Saddam Hussein regime that was ordered by President Bush, the son, because that removed the only force in Iraq, a terrible, brutal dictator, but the only force that could keep the country from spinning off into these old hatreds and so on.
It was also a buffer. It was also a buffer against Iran.
And a buffer against Iran, exactly. Now, but President Obama, of course, during his 2008 campaign, was very clear, and one reason he won the Democratic nomination is because he opposed the war in Iraq, said it was the wrong war, and promised to get us out. He did pull out our combat troops in 2011. He didn't leave any residual force, which the hawks in the United States say he should have done, and sort of pushed the Iraqi government to settle this dispute we had about whether our soldiers could be prosecuted under Iraqi law. Without that kind of protection, President Obama felt, and our military felt, that we were not going to leave our soldiers there if they could be prosecuted locally. This is a very common practice where American troops are. And so without the residual force, the people argue now, the conservatives argue that without that force, there was no way to stop this kind of insurgency that's taking over the huge swaths of the country north of Baghdad.
And I just wonder what the argument might be for what the president can do. I mean, you know, we've long seen dissatisfaction or complaints about the Obama foreign policy, the inability to do anything in Syria, the breakdown of negotiations in the Middle East, Russian shenanigans in Ukraine. But that leads to the obvious question. One, what should Obama have done? Or two, what should he be doing? And three, is there any desire in among the American people that decide that Iraq is worth fighting for?
Well, I think the last question is probably the easiest one to answer. The answer is no. The polling is very consistent. Americans are war weary. They feel after 9 years of war in Iraq, the loss of 4,500 American lives, 32,000 injured, about $2 trillion in spending and untold Iraqi deaths, people just don't want to go back in there again. And there's polling indicating people, most Americans feel it was a mistake. And so I think there's, in that sense, President Obama is really in sync with the public because a huge majority of Americans do not want us back in there again, certainly don't want combat troops. And so I think he's in sync. I think the other part of it that, Ken, I think you're alluding to is The other part of that, and it's a contradiction in some ways, Americans also are very troubled when the world seems to be out of control, when the American president seems weak, seems powerless, and not respected, and the United States doesn't seem respected. That's, I think, the subtext of a lot of what's going on now in Americans looking at foreign policy. There's a poll out this week just by NBC and Wall Street Journal indicating that 57% of Americans disapprove of the Obama foreign policy. But I think part of that is the notion of we look sort of like a weak and hapless country. And I think Americans are very troubled by that. And I think that's part of where Obama finds himself now. For some of the setbacks in Iraq, the negotiations with Iran over its nuclear power, Syria, Russia, Ukraine, you can even include the swap for Sergeant Bergdahl with the five Taliban detainees. Just goes on and on. And I think people feel, well, even though they might agree with Obama on not being militarily engaged in some of these places, they feel something's wrong, that we're not the strong, respected nation we used to be. And I think that troubles a lot of people.
Ken Walsh is the chief White House correspondent for U.S. News. Ken, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you.
Eric Cantor's replacement might be a shoo-in, but the replacement's replacement is a different story. We'll talk about who wants to be the next House Majority Whip. Stay tuned. The primaries resume next week in seven states. We're going to two of the big ones at stake, a Senate primary in Oklahoma and a House contest in Manhattan. Now, Oklahoma is not about to send a Democrat to the Senate this year, and a district centering in Harlem and parts of the Bronx is not going to elect a Republican to the House. But the results in both primaries may very well send a message. Let's start with Oklahoma. Both Senate seats are up because one of the incumbents, Tom Coburn, announced that he's calling it quits at the end of the year. And that leads to a special primary on Tuesday that, like we've seen with a lot of Republican contests this year, has a so-called establishment choice and a Tea Party alternative. Randy Crable is a political reporter with the Tulsa World. Randy, we'd love to focus on the establishment versus Tea Party angle, but no one can claim that either of the two Republican frontrunners for the Coburn seat is a moderate.
You know, I wouldn't think so. There's been some attempt to portray James Lankford as a moderate. He prefers to think of himself as a quiet conservative.
He's the congressman.
He is the 5th District congressman. The 5th District of Oklahoma is Oklahoma City and the surrounding area.
The other Republican is House Speaker T.W. Shannon.
He's actually technically the former speaker. He resigned as speaker when he entered the Senate race, but at any rate, we still refer to him as Mr. Speaker.
He seems to be the Tea Party candidate. What's attractiveness, the excitement about Shannon, and why is Lankford not sufficiently conservative to some Tea Party groups?
Well, this is an interesting thing. Shannon has gotten the backing of people like Ted Cruz and Sarah Palin and the Senate Conservatives Fund. And he's kind of been portrayed, I think, especially nationally as a Tea Party candidate. But he's not especially popular among the actual Tea Party people in Oklahoma. What it's really coming down to is Lankford is presenting himself as the guy who does his homework, is a problem solver, you know, wants to get things turned around, but you can't just, you know, say no to everything. Shannon has tended to take more of a hard line approach. A third party group that is supporting him has criticized Lankford for voting twice to raise the debt ceiling and also for his role in the budget agreement from last December.
Are there polls out showing how close this race is?
There hasn't been much independent polling. Lankford's campaign released a poll last week that showed him ahead by 7 points. The feeling I get from talking to people is that general wisdom is that Lankford has some kind of a lead. It might be 2 points. It might be 10 points. I mean, his people seem to think that they're ahead and that they could possibly win without a runoff. I should say there are 7 candidates in this race, but Shannon and Lankford seem to be far ahead of the others.
Aside from style, is there a major difference between the two leading candidates?
No, to answer your question. They're pretty much the same on issues. Their personal values are pretty much the same. They're both Southern Baptist. Langford is a minister. Shannon is kind of a lay preacher type of a guy and has the backing of J.C. Watts. Where they've tried to distinguish themselves is in how they approach problems. Langford tends to try and really pick them apart and get down to the details, whereas Shannon's more kind of a big picture kind of a guy.
Once upon a time, we used to lead these conversations about Oklahoma Senate races by talking about the Democratic candidate. Who is the Democratic candidate, or who will be the Democratic candidate?
In this particular race, as you mentioned, actually both Senate seats are up this year. It's the first time that's happened since statehood. So the main candidate is a state senator named Connie Johnson. She is a black woman. And so if T.W. Shannon were to win, we'd have the unusual situation in Oklahoma of having a general election between a black man and a black woman for the U.S. Senate.
That doesn't happen too often. I think, if memory serves, Barack Obama ran against Alan Keyes in Illinois in 2004 for the Senate. I think that's the only time in history you've had two black candidates running against each other for the Senate. It's kind of a remarkable how far the Democratic Party has fallen in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I mean, and sort of where the Democratic Party is in Oklahoma now is that a lot of the old Democrats, you know, the conservative Southern Democrats, most of those are gone. And so the people who are registering Democrats now are more like Democrats in the rest of the country. And they've got a ways to go. And in fact, some of us have commented that really the Democratic Party in Oklahoma is really almost a third party, that the two factions of the Republican Party are the first two, and the Democrats are still strong in some areas, but as far as statewide politics, they have a very tough time.
Randy Crable is a reporter for the Tulsa World. Randy, thanks a lot for being on the program.
All right, thanks.
And now we head east to New York's 13th Congressional District. Charles Rangel has held that seat since 1971, after he beat the legendary Adam Clayton Powell in the Democratic primary. Powell was legendary, all right, but he was only in Congress for 26 years. I say only because Rangel has been there for nearly 44 years. But Rangel's had his own problems in recent years. Ethics charges that led to him being censured by the House, a redistricting that's changed the demographics of his seat, and a familiar opponent who almost beat him last time out. We have two reporters talking to us about the race, Celeste Katz, a political reporter and blogger for the New York Daily News, and Raul Reyes, a USA Today columnist and NBC News contributor based in New York City. Welcome to you both.
Hey there.
Thank you.
Celeste, let's start with you. Rangel's up against Adriano Espaillat, who he just barely beat 2 years ago. Who is Espaillat, and what's the race looking like?
Adriano Espaillat is a former assemblyman. He's now a state senator. And he did come pretty close to beating Charlie Rangel in the primary in 2012, right after the boundaries of the district were changed. It was only about 1,000 votes, but Rangel pulled it out. Espaillat is coming back and looking for a win in the rematch.
Now, we're talking about, obviously, the rematch, but we're also talking about other candidates on the ballot, Raul. There's the Reverend Michael Waldron. There's Yolanda Garcia, who's a Bronx activist, also born in the Dominican Republic. These people could siphon off anti-Rangel votes, couldn't they? And I wonder how they got on the ballot.
Right. They both hold the potential to act as spoilers. Reverend Michael Waldron from Rangel and potentially, you know, Yolanda Garcia from either candidate. And one thing that's been very fascinating to me is from everything that I've read, including in the Daily News, Celeste, so maybe you know more about this, is that Yolanda Garcia is quite the phantom candidate. She doesn't speak English. She hasn't held one single campaign event. And so there's some mystery around her. I mean, Michael Waldron has, you know, is running an actual campaign. He is, you know, he has a website. He makes appearances. So they could, you know, well act as spoilers in this race. You know, it's going to be so close, and everything will depend on the turnout.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say who's going to spoil for who right now. And I'm sure we'll get into this, but there's certainly been a lot of discussion about the demographics, the, you know, race and ethnicity issues in this district, and whether that's going to present a problem for Rangel, or whether he can hold on for what he says will be his 23rd and final term. Turnout in New York City is awful generally. I mean, we just elected the first new mayor in 12 years in 2013, and about a quarter of the people who were eligible to show up to vote actually bothered to do so. So if you're thinking about, you know, a Democratic primary here, I think it's going to depend a lot on turnout. And so to your point, I think that may be where the endorsements matter. And it may not be so much the famous names like a Bill Clinton or whoever, but it might be the ground troops that can be provided if, you know, if they have the money to do so and the organization, and they can get people interested. You know, unions and groups like that can get people to work phone banks, to hand out literature, to work subway stations on the day of the election. It's just going to be interesting to see how many people are actually going to take an interest. I mean, does Rangel benefit from, you know, name ID and from people who traditionally, you know, have voted for him for many years? Does he benefit if the turnout is low? Or can Espaillat stir up enough people who want to see somebody new in that seat and actually, you know, get them out to the polls?
Raul, you touched on this a little bit a while ago, the issue about Black power and Latino power. When I think of Charles Rangel, or when anybody thinks of Charles Rangel, when you think of Adam Clayton Powell, you think of Black political power. But as you point out, the district is no longer Harlem. It's no longer majority African-American. So how has that changed Rangel's calculus? Tell me a little bit about the rivalry between Black and Latino political groups.
Well, in this instance, we're seeing a lot of, not so much just rivalry, say, between African-American and Latino groups. I see it more as splitting along a sort of a generational shift, like the old guard lining up much more with Rangel, and then a lot of the younger people, the newer guard, maybe switching over, and they see Espaillat as someone, you know, he's up and coming, there's an excitement about him, and maybe they're taking their chances with him, because, they, you know, I mean, to be honest, there is something, I have to say, you know, I've seen Espaillat, he loves campaigning, and for many people, there's, you know, especially Dominican Americans up in Washington Heights, it's exciting to be part of something where, you know, he could potentially make history as the first Dominican American congressman. So I do see that, but I see this more as something like a, almost like a demographic type of shift, and a little bit ironic too, because, you know, going back in the day, I believe it was Rangel, you know, years ago, who actually defeated Adam Clayton Powell way back when, and back at that time.
It wasn't that long ago.
It was like
old. Raul, it wasn't that long ago. I remember it. It wasn't that long ago.
No, it was. That was the whole thing. He was the, well, I mean, by that time, Powell had problems of his own, and he was considered kind of an, absentee congressman, I think.
Right.
So, you know, you can make an argument, you know, yes or no, whether Rangel was actually the, you know, just kind of the giant killer at that time. But just go back for 1 second, because I think it's very interesting talking about these splits here. I think it's also important to remember, and I don't know how much of a role this is going to play, but, you know, if you look at, you can definitely say that the district as reconfigured has a much larger Latino population.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that they're going to vote as a monolith. Because there's not necessarily, you know, and from what you see and from what you hear and talking to people, there's not always necessarily, an accord between, say, Dominican groups and Puerto Rican groups. You know, this is not, you know, when you say just because you speak Spanish, you're going to vote for this candidate.
Right, right.
I don't think you can make that argument safely at all.
Celeste, you were talking about Adam Clayton Powell's ethics problems back in 1970. Obviously, Charles Rangel has ethics problems, too. We saw that after he was censured by the House in 2010. Now, he faced the voters in 2012. What's the view of him these days regarding his ethics?
I think a lot of people see it now. You know, I mean, they remember certainly that he had issues, but I mean, Nancy Pelosi is still supporting him. I mean, you still have a lot of his friends in Congress. He's been around for a long time. He does not have quite the power that he had when he was running Ways and Means. And the way I'd boil it down is that probably a lot of people see it as if he was going to get hurt by that, by the ethics issues, it would have happened before. And now maybe the issues are different. Maybe some people are just asking, you know, okay, so you got through that one. You got your 22nd term. Isn't that enough, Why are you unsatisfied with that? Why must you keep going? And, you know, maybe is it time for somebody new? But Rangel says he feels good. He's had some health problems, too, in recent years, but he says he's feeling much better, and he doesn't want to be seen as kind of the old guy who needs to get out of the way. You know, he still feels like he has work to do.
Yeah, and, you know, there is another wild card also in this, and although we won't know how it all plays out, but there is a group, it's a nonpartisan group, it's called Dominicanos USA, which is I think it's relatively new, but they have been doing tremendous voter registration in the district. Now, they're officially nonpartisan, so they're not necessarily recruiting people to vote for Yes Bayat, but nonetheless, like they certainly have been focusing all over Washington Heights, and, you know, they say they've registered, brought in thousands of new voters. And, you know, it is exciting when people vote the first time, or maybe, you know, you can sort of make that connection with a new voter to get them psyched to vote, you know, to vote for a candidate. That voter registration could also make a difference in the turnout, which would definitely benefit Espaillat.
So what's the mood in the district right now? And if you were a betting person, without money, of course, but if you were a betting person, what happens on Tuesday?
Go ahead, Raul.
Go ahead, Celeste. I'm going to go with Espaillat.
Really?
Only because I think the excitement is there, and I think people tend to vote. Voters tend to vote for something that's new and fresh over, you know, when they're given the choice, they'll go with, like you know, hope and change. And so if I had to make a bet, I would say Espaillat.
I'm going to be the washout here to not make a bet, but I'll put it this way. If Espaillat can generate enough excitement and get enough ground game together to actually get people to show up, he has a very decent shot here. I don't think this is an easy race for Rangel. But if people are not excited about the race, if they stay home, if the weather is bad, or you know, anything like that, then Rangel could see the benefit there.
Well, my prediction is that anybody listening from New York needs to read Celeste Katz and Raul Reyes. Celeste Katz is a political reporter and blogger with the New York Daily News. You can follow her on Twitter at Celeste Katz NYC. Celeste, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Raul Reyes is a USA Today columnist and contributor at NBC. You can follow him at Raul A. Reyes. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.
Thank you both. It was great.
Bye-bye.
And don't forget, we have a new Predict the Winners contest for the June 24th primaries. The person who comes closest to picking the victorious candidates in 10 selected races will get not only the valuable and lovely Political Junkie button, but will be on next week's show. Check out our newly updated and improved website for more details at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Well, we finally recovered from the shock of Eric Cantor being upset in last Tuesday's primary in Virginia. Now it's time for the Republicans in Congress to update their leadership team. Cantor is stepping down as majority leader, and there'll be an election for a majority whip as well. And Michael Crittenden of the Wall Street Journal is watching it all with a tally sheet. He joins us from Capitol Hill via cell phone. Mike, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Happy to be here, Ken.
So when Eric Cantor was defeated, the feeling was that the Tea Party conservatives would make a move for the majority leader position. But right now, it's like Kevin McCarthy, the GOP whip, is going to move up, and that's that.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into these leadership races that are well beyond like the simple media narratives that, you know, maybe came out in the first day or two after Cantor lost. I mean, I think a lot of people were just flat caught off guard. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. The likely next majority leader is Kevin McCarthy, who's a member of leadership. There's a chance that the next majority whip is Pete Roskam, who is the current chief deputy whip. So it might be that everyone just moves up a position.
Who is Kevin McCarthy, and in what ways is he different than Eric Cantor?
Very different styles. Kevin McCarthy is from California, won the lottery on a scratch-off ticket when he was a teenager at opened a deli as one of his first things he did in life. He used to work for longtime Congressman Bill Thomas. And then he's been Congressman 7-8 years. Yeah, he hasn't been here that long. It's actually a surprise he's moved up so quickly. But a lot of his backers and even the folks running against him will tell you, listen, he's been great at the whip's job, at least part of the whip's job, which is being social, where being the type of guy that people can go to in leadership. One lawmaker told me the other day, you know, I'd be scared as hell to call John Boehner at midnight, but I know if I needed to call Kevin McCarthy at any hour of the day, I could. Sort of your classic retail politician, just hobnobbing up here with other lawmakers.
He's also raised a lot of money for his colleagues.
Well, yes, and that's always a very important part in leadership races. And it sort of goes back to what I was saying earlier. There's a lot that goes into these races beyond just ideology. And one of those things is lawmakers give a lot of money to each other. A lot of the lawmakers have leadership PACs where they use that. They raise money through those that they then give to other lawmakers to help them in their races. Say you're a lawmaker who wants to move up the totem pole and you see one of your colleagues is facing a tough primary, a tough race. You give him some money. Next time there's a leadership race or a committee chairmanship or subcommittee chairmanship opens and you're vying to get that, you know, you go lean on him for some support.
Well, in terms of full disclosure, I should say that the election, we are doing this interview the day before the election, and Kevin McCarthy does have an opponent, Raul Labrador of Idaho, is also running, but it looks like McCarthy is the odds-on favorite.
Yeah, I think the feeling here is generally that, barring something very unforeseen, that Kevin McCarthy will be the next majority leader. Now, I think one important thing we've started to figure out, cotton to the last couple of days, is Kara Care is not stepping down as majority leader till the end of July. Lawmakers are out all of August, and then they're only in a short period of time, September, before they go home to start preparing for the November election. So, in effect, Kevin McCarthy, if he is the next majority leader, or Raul Labrador, technically, there's only going to be 12 official legislative business days that Congress is in session. Well, either of them would be the next House Majority Leader, because after November's elections, they're going to have to go through this process again.
And there are three Republicans, Peter Roskam of Illinois, Marlon Stutzman of Indiana, and Steve Scalise of Louisiana, all running for the job. Tell me about them.
Well, the Whip's race is interesting, because the Whip's job is basically he's the guy with the tally sheet, keeps track, figures out, do we have the votes to get this bill passed on the floor? And the way Republicans have traditionally run it under, you know, former Speaker Dennis Hastert is to move a bill to the floor, you should be able to pass any bill with a majority of Republicans. So you want to make sure your caucus is basically ready to go on a bill and supports it. And so that's the Whip's job, is to basically take the temperature, have a good feeling for where people are on a bill. This race is actually more sort of the narrative we were talking about earlier, where it's maybe a more conservative Republican versus what many people would see more traditional sort of establishment. Steve Scalise is head of the Republican Study Committee, a conservative group here in the House of Representatives that, you know, has really started to impose its will in recent years. I mean, stuff like spending cuts, the shutdown, a lot of these, the debt limit fight, very ideologically focused. And Steve Scalise is their leader. He came out swinging last week and is seen as probably having the lead in the Whip's race. Behind him is Mr. Roskam, who is the current chief deputy whip, basically McCarthy's chief deputy. He's from Illinois, but, you know, he's also a member of the Republican Study Committee, as is Mr. Stutzman. So you have three conservative lawmakers. The one wrinkle that is coming into this is that a lot of Republicans, particularly those guys from red states, are sort of chafing at the fact that no member of the House Republican leadership team actually is from a red state. John Boehner's obviously from Ohio. Kevin McCarthy's from California. The fourth in line, the conference chair, Kathy McMorris Rodgers, is from Washington. And Eric Cantor's from Virginia, which voted for Obama in 2012 as well. So Steve Scalise, one of his big pitch points has been, hey, I'm from Louisiana. I come from a red state. We need to have representation in the ranks as well.
Yeah, I was going to say he's the only Southerner running, and if Peter Roskam is his main challenger, well, Roskam and Boehner are both Midwesterners. You can make the case that the South needs leadership. They used to have, remember, Dick Armey and Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich and other Southerners in the leadership, but Scalise is the only Southerner.
Right, and that's what some of his supporters have made. Now, whether or not that will hold is very questionable. I mean, some of Roskam's chief sort of supporters and the guys whipping votes for him this week are folks like Trey Gowdy, the guy who's going to chair the Benghazi Commission for House Republicans
from South Carolina.
Yeah, one of the most conservative House Republicans. So it's gonna be weird. The splits, I think how things break down are gonna be very interesting. A lot of it is sort of like a high school student council race where, maybe one person comes out with lots of confidence and you're trying to convince everyone that you're gonna win, because as one lawmaker told me last week, at the end of the day, people want to back the guy they think's gonna win. They wanna be on the side of the winner so that maybe it benefits them down the road. But it's interesting to sort of see the different dynamics at play, where you have lawmakers who have close relationships because maybe they do Bible study together, or they play on the same congressional baseball team, or they sit next to each other at committee. So there's a lot of these weird personal, professional interactions that play a much bigger role than you'd expect.
Michael Crittenden is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. You can follow him on Twitter at CritterDJ. Thanks a lot for being on the show, Mike.
Always happy to.
Coming up, This Week in Political History looks back at Ralph Nader's run for the White House in 2000 and its unintended effects. I'm Ken Rudin, and you're listening to The Political Junkie from WAMU in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Welcome back to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. It just so happens, I'm Ken Rudin. It's time for This Week in Political History. The year is 2000, and we're at the presidential nominating convention of the Green Party. 4 years earlier, the Green Party endorsed consumer advocate Ralph Nader as its presidential candidate. He got all of 0.7% in November, a total of 685,000 votes nationwide. His best showings, 3.6% in Oregon, 3.1% in Alaska, and 0.0% in political coverage. If the focus wasn't on President Clinton or Bob Dole in 1996, it was on Reform Party candidate Ross Perot. But in 2000, the presidency was open. Clinton was term limited. No Ross Perot. The candidates were Al Gore, the vice president, and George W. Bush, the governor of Texas. And once again, the Greens backed Nader.
On behalf of all Americans who seek a new direction, who yearn for a new birth of freedom to build the just society, who see justice as the great work of human beings on earth, who understand that community and human fulfillment are mutually self-enforcing, who respect the urgent necessity to wage peace, to protect the environment, to end poverty, and to preserve values of the spirit for future generations, who wish to build a deep democracy by working hard for a regenerative, progressive politics. To all these citizens and the Green Vanguard, I welcome and am honored to accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Nader campaigned long and hard. He talked about the corporate influence in American lives. He talked about child care and the environment and wars and the sense of powerlessness. He was never going to win the election, and that was never the point. But he had a message to deliver, and he had his say. And more people paid attention. Nationally, he went from 685,000 votes in 1996 to 2.9 million votes. And he got votes in red and blue states alike, 10% in Alaska, 7% in Vermont, 6% in Hawaii, in Maine, in Massachusetts, in Montana. Boy, that's a beaut. He didn't do so well in Florida, only 1.6% of the vote, about 97,000 votes. But that was in a state that Al Gore lost to George W. Bush by just 537 votes. Now, sure, you can blame Nader for Gore's defeat, and many Democrats did, and still do. Don't you think that, given the choice between Bush and Gore, most of Nader's 97,000 votes would have gone to Gore? Who knows? But there was also Pat Buchanan, the Reform Party nominee. He got 17,000 votes in Florida. Libertarian Harry Brown got 16,000. Would those votes have gone to Bush over Gore? And, as Nader has pointed out in the 13 or 14 years since, what about the 100,000 Florida Democrats who voted for Bush in 2000? Nonetheless, the legacy of Ralph Nader, at least as far as many Democrats are concerned, is that he elected George W. Bush. That question did come up in August of 2008 when we had Nader on the Political Junkie segment on NPR's Talk of the Nation. The question came in from a caller named Mike from Boca Raton, Florida.
Mr. Candidate, considering what's happened since the year 2000. Don't you think that your candidacy creates too much of a risk of unintended consequences based on your past performance?
Well, the social scientists who studied that say that Gore won the election. He won the popular vote. The Electoral College stood in his way, and the press investigations and others in Florida indicate, and Gore believes this, that he won Florida, but it was taken from him before, during, and after Election Day in all kinds of tricky ways that have been subject of documentaries and investigations to the five Republicans who in the Supreme Court who selected George W. Bush. So I keep saying to the Democrats, look in the mirror, go after the thieves, because they might do it again, and there was a lot of shenanigans in Ohio, the swing state that left Kerry behind.
When, which of the two candidates would you prefer to be the next president, the other two candidates?
No, the ones that are closer to the agenda of Nader Gonzalez.
Well, you know, I'm all for anybody being able to run, but candidly, we can't stand another 8 years of George Bush and McCain in that crowd.
Nor can we. In fact, if Al Gore picked up my withering criticism in detail of Bush's record in Texas when he was governor, he'd have won even over these obstacles that the Republicans illegally put in his way.
Ralph Nader has spent decades fighting corporations on behalf of the powerless. It was 14 years ago this week, in June of 2000, when Nader was nominated for president, again by the Green Party. And to many Democrats, it became one of the most consequential third-party candidacies in history. You're listening to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the first presidential wife to run for any kind of office? And the first one is the only one, Hillary Clinton, in 2000, when she was elected to the U.S. Senate from New York. There were people who wanted Eleanor Roosevelt to run for one office or the other in the 1950s, but only Hillary Clinton, among all the former first ladies, ran for office. And the winner is Charlie Jones of Sacramento, California. Charlie gets the political junkie button. And last week's scuttle button puzzle, there was a button that read Macon, Georgia. I love it. Billy Lovett ran for governor of Georgia in 1982. Then came Wu for Senate from Delaware and a George P. Bush for Texas Land Commissioner. That's a new button from this year. And that leaves you with Macon Whoopee.
The trees, the birds and bees are making whoopee.
The old Eddie Cantor, not Eric Cantor, song from 1928.
Another victim is by her side. He's lost his reason, 'cause it's the season for making whoopee.
And the winner is James McCracken of Evanston, Illinois. You can keep up with the latest scuttle button puzzles, trivia, and political yakking at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Good wages.
A few weeks ago, you political junkies teamed up to crowdsource an answer about, of all things, political morticians and funeral directors. It was a very grave discussion. Well, this time we've got a question of the international variety. Here it is from a Google voicemail inbox.
Hi, this is Ian Richmond from Austin, Texas, originally from Belfast, Northern Ireland. My question is, what is the highest political office ever achieved by a naturalized citizen who was naturalized as an adult?
So we want to hear from you, political junkies. Let me repeat Ian's question. What's the highest political office ever achieved by a naturalized citizen who was naturalized as an adult? Call and leave a natural message at our Political Junkie Google inbox. That's 316-KEN-9646, 316-536-9646. We can figure this out. We are in this together. Welcome back. You're listening to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. With all this chatter about whether the Tea Party is up or down or sideways or whatever, a lot of people might have missed the news that some giants are leaving Congress, some because of defeats, some because of age, some because they've had enough. Voters in Virginia's 7th District last week threw out the House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, who brought money and power into the Old Dominion for an untested Tea Party newcomer. We already know about the voluntary retirements of longtime incumbent John Dingell and Henry Waxman and George Miller and Frank Wolfe, to name just a few. And next week, the careers of Thad Cochran and Charlie Rangel. They've each been in office since the 1970s. Their careers are in serious jeopardy. Norm Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and is a longtime expert on Congress. Norm, welcome to the Political Junkie.
It's great to be with you, Ken, as a fellow political junkie.
Well, you know, we always say change is good, and we're going to see a lot of change in the next Congress, a lot of new faces. But if Thad Cochran is going to lose next week, if Charlie Rangel's long career is about to come to an end, you know, these guys have been here for a long time, and they've compiled pretty lengthy and somewhat impressive records.
There is something, whatever one's political views, to lament in the departure of people who have such a long institutional memory and the ability to step in whenever a policy is being considered and say, you know, we tried that and here's why it won't work, or we've tried to do this for years and we're just going to keep pushing to make it happen. A lot of people won't like that answer because there's a strong and continuing belief out there in term limits. But I lament the loss of some people, and there is no such thing as being indispensable. But, you know, if Thad Cochran loses in a primary to a candidate sharply to his right and somebody who has made some pretty horrific mistakes during the course of this campaign, it's not even so much the loss of a Cochran as it is the implications that will be drawn from that loss, just as the ones from Eric Cantor's loss by an awful lot of members. The notion that if you care about the institution and about the regular order, just the fact that you've been there for a period of time disqualifies you from service, no matter what the views of your opponent. And to take it to another level and an extension of that, you're a politician. We don't want politicians. And what does that mean we get instead? People who see the world in stark black and white terms, no need to compromise, pedal to the metal to bring the place to a complete halt. I don't think that's really what the American people would be happy with.
Charlie Rangel, if he loses next Tuesday, obviously for different reasons, there are ethics questions, his age, but mostly about questions about ethics. And of course, his district is changing. It's no longer just Harlem. It's taken in parts of the Bronx, taken in a lot of Latino parts of this district. But whatever Charles Rangel is today, I mean, once upon a time, he was a pretty powerful, influential member of Congress.
And a powerful, influential, savvy and pragmatic member of Congress as well. Somebody who played a very constructive role on the Ways and Means Committee. Now, I do think that this is a case as much of a personal tragedy as anything else. Rangel got himself into some ethical problems, I think because as a number of people who've served for a very long time have, he simply was unwilling to recognize what the standards were or that standards had changed, and I think became caught up enough in his own power that he thought he could be immune to such things. That's really too bad, and most of these things were relatively petty, but they're real. Having said that, they were far more visible a couple of years ago, but I think you've hit on the other important factor. Just an awful lot of voters now who are not going to be moved by the history of Charlie Rangel, the large number of things that he did that caused him to accumulate a significant amount of power and prestige and respect inside Congress. And the ethnic polls are different ones now. So he's more vulnerable than he was when those ethical issues were red hot.
We keep hearing about a lot of anger with Congress, and mostly we're hearing it on the Republican side, just angry, you know, with its members, with the institution. But if there was so much anger, wouldn't we have seen more primary defeats? I mean, more than half the states have already had their primaries, and only two incumbents have lost, Ralph Hall, who's 91 years old in Texas, and Eric Cantor.
You know, it's interesting. Our conventional wisdom just a few weeks ago, when not a single incumbent had been defeated, was angry people, the mob with pitchforks and boiling oil, have receded. The establishment, especially of the Republican Party, is back on top, and the others, the Tea Party people, are on their heels. Now, Ralph Hall's defeat had far more to do with him being 91 years old than anything else. But Eric Cantor's is a different matter. Now, you know, you could step back from that and make the point that you just made, which is, yes, people are angry out there, but obviously it's not translating into a throw-the-bums-out attitude. And the fact is, once we get past this primary season, the number of incumbents who are in serious trouble is pretty tiny as well. Most of these districts are safe for one party or the other, and voters increasingly are voting their party line. So if they're angry, they're not going to say, I don't care if I'm a Democrat and he or she is a Democrat, I'm a Republican, he or she is a Republican, I'm going to throw that bum out. They're going to vote and toe the party line. I think a couple of points need to be made about this, Ken. One is the numbers, the statistics don't matter for most members. All it takes is one pungent example to scare them all to death. So you could look at Eric Cantor's defeat. It was a surge in turnout. It was a new district in many ways that was made more safe for a Republican in the fall, but less safe for Eric Cantor because it took in a lot of territory that was not particularly warm towards him. He ran a lousy campaign. There were a number of other reasons for a backlash. But a lot of Republicans look at what happened to Cantor and they're saying, oh, my God, that could happen to me. And the lessons that they may draw from this will reflect an exaggerated view of where that anger is, or at least what might happen from it. And I think there's one other factor here, too, which is the money disparity was quite remarkable. Cantor had $5 million. Dave Bratt had about $200,000 or so. Now, I would make a case that actually the money disparity was less because Cantor was uneasy enough that he spent over $1 million on ads attacking Bratt improbably as a liberal. And that gave Bratt name recognition that he never would have had. And the attacks were so absurd that I think it created a backlash. But a lot of these members who would otherwise be fairly secure knowing that they'll have a war chest are not going to feel as secure anymore. Now, having said that, one, the anger is real. Americans are not happy with Congress. It's not just, it's business as usual, which means no business at all. There is a populist anger, especially on the right, but some of it hits the left as well. And if it's not channeling itself through the electoral process with turnover there, you wonder how it will channel itself. And one of the things that makes me uneasy is it provides some riper territory for a demagogue to come along, and that can include a potential presidential candidate.
When you're looking at the Cantor defeat, obviously that there's this change in the leadership in the House, and looks like Kevin McCarthy will be the next majority leader. Now, you've watched Congress for a long, long time. Kevin McCarthy's only been in the House for 4 terms. What happened to the old thought that you have to put in your time before you can rise in leadership?
You know, that's been more true in the House than in the Senate. If you look back, Lyndon Johnson's rise to power in the Senate came with remarkable swiftness in a body where seniority was even more venerated. So it's been different at different times. But I think, you know, the unease with leadership in the House, Republicans being relatively new to majority power, with a couple of iterations of that, have created openings for some younger members. What's, of course, interesting here is that Cantor, McCarthy, and the now famous Paul Ryan all created this group heading into the 2010 elections called the Young Guns. And it was, we've got a new movement, a new conservative movement on the Republican side. They did a book which conspicuously failed to pay even the slightest nod to their leader, Speaker John Boehner. And they all went out there to recruit Tea Party candidates with a populist anger that worked like a charm in 2010 and then came back to bite Eric Cantor in 2014. But Kevin McCarthy has been able to still ride that Young Guns wave forward. I think we looked at this with some skepticism, just looking ahead to any leadership contests among the House Republicans, belief that the establishment would be tossed in favor of a more radical group. But that also would have included some younger members and junior members. And now the favorite, at least for the position that Kevin McCarthy has held, the whip's position, is Steve Scalise, who's not a very senior man himself.
We've had a lot of guests come on the show and say that losing these long-serving members of Congress isn't just sad or the end of an era, but it means that there's a loss in institutional knowledge and a respect for the rules. Do you see old traditions in Congress fading away?
Yeah, we haven't had the traditions emerge for some time. And that includes a respect for the institution itself, for what it represents, for what we call in the trade the regular order. And that means at least some nod to debate and deliberation, to a process where you have amendments on the floor, you have some give and take. If you pass a bill out of a committee or a subcommittee or committee, that the members work to make that bill succeed in the House, but then have a comparable bill go through the Senate and go to a conference committee where you can iron out the differences before you bring it back. A sense that programs and agencies are supposed to be reauthorized every few years so that you can take a look at them and see what's working and what hasn't. A notion that you do real oversight, not the gotcha variety, but actually look at the details of programs, try and make government work better. All of those things fit under the rubric of the regular order. They're venerated by the more senior members on both sides of the aisle. They've been venerated by a core of staff on committees especially who have been there through numerous changes in party control, chairs and ranking members and the like, who are now also making their way in large numbers to the exits. And the newer members who are taking over not only lack the institutional memory, but most of them have disdain for their own institution. You know, a lot of members in the old days would rather cynically run against their own institution so they could channel the public unhappiness with Congress, which is built into, baked into the DNA of American politics, and basically say, hey, I'm not like the rest of them. I'm Wyatt Earp trying to clean up that awful saloon. But they really did care about their own institution. The members come in and now really believe this stuff. They believe it's awful, and they're there only because it's the best vehicle to try and implement the revolutions that they want. And that's not a healthy thing, I think, for the future of our institutions and constitutional system.
Norm Ornstein studies Congress as a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Norm, thanks so much for being on the show.
It's a pleasure, Ken.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Want to catch the podcast? You can subscribe on iTunes, add us to your Stitcher playlist, and track us down on TuneIn Radio. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus Junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttlebutt puzzles, you can visit us on the web at our new and vastly improved website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. Don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash, I'm not kidding about the cash, to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And you can find The Political Junkie on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. Check it out. It's brand new with a lot of new features. And also, if you have a question you need answered, or if you're just lonely and need someone to talk to, call our Google voicemail inbox at 316-KEN-9646. That's 316-536-9646. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.